How much cash should you keep in your savings account? I have the answer coming up after this.
From the streets of San Antonio, straight to your wallet, it's Jake's 2 cents on Jake of All Trades.
All right, welcome back. My name is Kirk, and I'm not a financial expert.
But I'm Jake, and I am the financial expert. And together, Kirk and I talk about financial planning, we talk about the economy, and we review financial articles, all with the express purpose of helping our listeners build wealth both today and into the future.
And we're going to talk about my favorite subject, me. No, I'm just kidding. We are going to talk about something that I think is applicable to everybody in terms of figuring out how, which is a very personal question, but the question today is, and this is something I asked Jake as my financial planner, you know, how much money should I keep in cash reserves, right? And, you know, how much should I put in investments? That's hard and impossible to put to get. How much should I, you know, should I take this bonus and keep it in my cash reserves, or should I put it into, you know, my 403? For me, it's because I'm at work at a nonprofit, it's 403B. And so we're going to talk about it. I'm going to try to get as specific as possible with my own situation, so you guys get an idea even what it feels like to work with the CFP and the different situations. Because the reality is, the reason you should work with the CFP is that it's different for everybody. There is no like hard and fast rule of how much cash, just, and this is just one financial, you know, example, like how much cash should you have? You know, we just did a show on, you know, renting car insurance and how to do that, and like how much you should spend on each individual thing and what kind of budget. You know, there's just so much to consider. How much you should invest, you know, should you do an HSA versus, like, there's just so many things that are, some of it's personal and it's not necessarily, or it's all personal. It's not necessarily, you know, like it's going to be different if you, like, if you say I'm never going to have kids. So you're going to plan way differently than if you think I'm gonna want kids one day. Right. Like,
yeah. And that's also going to change how much cash you should have in your bank account.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It all kind of works together.
Yeah. So like just a quick background on my situation. If you haven't, I started on the Jake of All Trades show working a couple years ago. One of our early episodes was Kirk in an RV, and we, maybe I'll try and remember to link that up so you could see, you know, like I went through this interesting thing where I was going to do an RV to kind of save some money and do a road show. And I found out that that was, you know, not the most plausible thing, but that's the kind of thing that I do, is I am very, very, what's the word? Risk tolerant. I'm very tolerant of risk.
High risk tolerance.
I have a high, high risk tolerance. And, you know, I've pursued a life of art and, you know, creating art. I create magazines, literary magazines and things like that. And I haven't necessarily done, I've done a bad job of managing finances. Like, I don't want to be, kind, I guess. Like, I'm trying to be honest. So, you know, I haven't done the best job with thinking about finances. I've always put it off and thought about, like, well, one day I'm going to be a, you know, a mega bestseller and I'll make millions of dollars, so I don't have to worry about money now. That was literally how I thought on some level. And I just pushed everything aside. Like, you know, I didn't even pay attention to my school debt.
Loans.
My school loans. Like, I just, you know, like they would call me all the time and I would just hang up on them. Right? It's like, they would sound like it doesn't exist. And just for years and years. And so like, I just recently paid off my school loans, but it was 22,000 that I had left. I mean, I paid a little bit. I did have some, but I don't even want to know how much I actually took out, because a lot of that was interest. Mm-hmm. Over years, like probably thousands of dollars. Cause I did not go to an Ivy League or a night, you know, great school. I went to the University of Colorado, Denver. So not even the University of Colorado, which is the UTSA. So it's much cheaper. And I paid for some of it at the time. So I didn't take out all the loans for everything. So it's like, you know, I probably only had 12,000 in loans. And I'll say, I just want to add this, sorry for my, you know, long discussion at the beginning, but just so you have a background, when I called the debt collector, it was actually at like 30,000, but they said if I was willing to pay it all up front, they would give me a truncated thing of like, it was 21,000.
Awesome. Yes.
So I was like, yeah, I'll do that. Cause luckily I did put a couple $1,000s into an investment account like 15 years ago. And apparently I didn't even notice this, but my parents put a couple thousand here and there and it grew to like, you know, almost 30,000. So I just took all of that. I was like, all right, I'm just going to pay this. Saves me $9,000. I'm good to go. And now I'm basically debt free. And I have 5 streams of income, right? So at least, so I have stuff from my website, Troubadour Magazine, where I have a monthly subscription for a literary canon club. People are paying that. And there's quite a few members paying a good amount of money in that. And then I have book sales. I have Amazon book sales. I have KGB Media Services, where I'm providing services for clients of, you know, production, co-hosting, things of that nature, marketing stuff. And then I have a, you know, a full-time job. So all those things are, you know, on the side, and the full-time job, which is a nice full-time job that allows me flexibility to do things like that.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's overall, my income has skyrocketed compared to what I was making before, which was like basically an entry-level type job was income. But now I'm making, you know, not like high level management, but I'm, you know, in, let's just say I'm in the range of 6 figures type thing.
Yeah.
Which is quite a jump.
Uh-huh.
And so now the situation is, you know, I'm debt free, and this is where Jake, I'll bring you in. Sorry for the long rant, more debt free. I have a motorcycle that I'm selling off. For now, although I'll probably buy another one in the future, but I want to just sell this one off to be completely debt free. And then, you know, I have the car and the apartment and a dog and that's it.
That's it.
And you know, I have a 403B that, is very nice that I'll, you know, max out, which is basically 401k for nonprofits and so on and so forth.
So I love that you've illustrated all of the moving parts of your situation in order for us to address this magical question about cash, because that is what is necessary to come to the proper answer for the question of how much I should keep in my savings account. It's so, I get this question a lot because people will read online 3 to 6 months of expenses, right? 3 to 6 months of expenses. That's what you should keep in cash. And when you think about that, a lot of times that can result in relatively high levels of cash if you spend a decent amount of money every month. But the reality is that the role that cash plays in your financial plan is a lifeline, right? And so it needs to only be viewed from that perspective, because if we don't view our cash from the perspective of it being a lifeline, then we feel like we're missing opportunities for investment or missing opportunities for spending, or, you know, we should be doing something else with this. So the first thing I always counsel clients on is, one, our cash is our lifeline, and therefore we don't want our lifeline to go away or to fluctuate much, because once we agree on how deep our lifeline needs to be, it needs to be there in that form throughout our lifetime, because we never know at what point life's going to throw a curveball and we're going to need to use that lifeline. It could be loss of a job. It could be loss of a big client. It could be health related. It could be an accident. It could be some external factor that, you know, your apartment burns down and now you've got to move and replenish all of your stuff. All of those situations are risks that could occur. And if, as long as we have a comfortable cushion, we can handle those risks without disrupting the rest of our plans as to what we're investing in the 403B or as to what we're doing with other investments that we might have. And so that's really why cash is the most important first step in constructing your financial plan, is making sure you have a cushion. Now, the amount of the cushion completely depends on your situation. And there's a lot of variables that influence whether or not your cash should be slightly higher or slightly lower than somebody else. So let's talk about what those variables are. The first one is, what's your composition of your income? Are you collecting income exclusively from an employer in the form of wages? If we are, that speaks to a little bit more of a capacity to have less cash, because I have a stable, hopefully stable, employer that's consistently providing me with a regular source of income that's unlikely to be disrupted unless I lose my job or I decide to quit, right? So under that context, it might mean that you don't need to keep a full 6 months of your living expenses in cash because it's unlikely that your income is going to be disrupted significantly moving forward. Does that make sense?
Yes. Although with me, that's a little, so an interesting snag on that is that my industry, my profession, that's not quite as true as certain other professions, like your profession, right?
Sure.
Like I'm in a sales profession and salespeople are often first ones cut. I think like that's, it's something that a lot of companies view as a, you know,
that's
a
an
luxury.
Important distinction.
So you have to think about, you know, like to kind of increase sales, but if things start getting tight, they're not going to pay the, you know, salespeople to go out there and do those sorts of things. Necessary. I mean, it depends on the company, but sometimes, you know, or like if things are a little difficult in the economy and you're not making quite the sales, like salespeople are the first ones to be cut, which is part of the gig to some degree. Like if you're not making enough sales, you're not going
to
stay there. So it's unlike some,
you're not performing your job.
Yeah. Like it's part of your job. And I get that. Like it's just part of the deal essentially. Mm-hmm. And it's also part of why, you know, salespeople do try to command decent wages. Because during those times, you know, they want to make sure, you know, if they're bringing in a good amount of money, of course, then they want to get a percentage of that or something. But the point is that for me, I always take into consideration what I call, you know, being punched in the gut at some point, you know, because the one time I got fired, for instance, I think I was doing the best that I could. It was, you know, fired, let go. The whole team was let go, basically, because I was working for an account software company. We were selling accounting software. Mm-hmm. And they had been selling the same software for 20 years and they were doing very good. And then they were trying to sell a new kind of software called NetSuite, which was, I won't get into the details, but they brought me on and, you know, somebody else that was going to go on. And then basically nobody really made any sales ever for like, you know, 8 months or something like that. And so the company was trying to go into this new industry, this new thing, and it didn't work out. And so of course the salespeople are the ones who get cut. And I get it. It's, you know, the way it worked and the business model for that one didn't happen. But the point is that kind of thing is more likely
in a sales role.
In my particular role. And I'm sure there are other roles. Like if you're in upper management, you know, if you're in the C-suite management, like you get cut all the time. You know, COOs, sure. CEOs, CFOs, those are the ones that, you know, in publicly traded companies, they get cut all the time. Although, you know, if you're a publicly traded company, it's probably millions of dollars you're talking about. But
right. Well,
still, the point is that you're, you know, you have to look at your profession as another snag.
Yep, absolutely. And so that's a great example too. And that kind of ties into the second aspect of that income conversation, which you happen to have both. You have while there is some risk to your role with your employer, you still receive W-2 wages, which are relatively stable, but you also receive self-employment.
You mean 1099?
Income. No, W-2 from ARI. That's your W-2 wages.
But I thought you said on top of ARI.
No, you receive 1099 or self-employment wages on top of what you receive from ARI. So, and typically someone who receives 1099 wages tend to have a bit more cash because their income is in flux, right? If you don't get as many buyers of a book for the month, maybe you lose a big client. There's the potential that from month to month, there could be some substantial disruptions in your cash flow. That translates into typically a slightly higher need to keep a little bigger cushion of cash so that you can supplement if things become lean. So your situation is unique in that you dabble in both pools, and that sort of translates, even though there is a risk with your wages from ARI because of your job, the role that you have, there's a little risk there that maybe it's not as stable as maybe someone who is working in the accounting department, for example, it still provides you with some stability.
Yeah.
So I would advise in that instance, we follow the guidelines of somebody that's employed under a stable role with the impetus being a slightly lower balance of cash that we keep on hand.
Okay. So like So I was thinking about what you were mentioning earlier, the 3 to 6 month rule of thumb. So not necessarily, you know, think about these different variables, but, you know, having something like 3 to 6 months. So for me, you know, like my rent is pretty low right now for my income, I think. Like it's...
Let's put numbers to it.
Yeah, like I think with everything, you know, with electricity, with, you know, I think it's like $1,350 a month for my apartment. And
then you have a car loan.
Yeah, I have a car loan. It's like $250. It was a small car loan. You know, right now I have a motorcycle, but I'm trying to sell that. So that's $300 with the motorcycle. But like I said, we're going to sell it, like 99% sure.
Yeah.
So it's, I wouldn't include that right now. Yeah, I mean, phone bill, $100, gas, food, you know, $500.
So let's say we add another $500 a month for incidentals.
Yeah. And then my crazy shopping addiction right now.
Well, so kidding. That brings up a good point, right? If we think about, and this is where the rule of thumb of 3 to 6 months kind of becomes irrelevant, because you just illustrated the point, right? If I am in a situation, if I find myself in a situation where I'm needing to rely on my savings for whatever reason, you're probably not going to be spending at the same rate that you were before this event occurred. And so when I just arbitrarily say, well, my budget every month, because it includes that discretionary spending, is $3,000 a month, and I save, you know, $9,000 so that I have 3 months of my expenses in savings. In reality, if I'm in a situation where I need to live on my cash, I'm probably not going to spend $3,000 a month, right? I'm probably going to cut that. There's going to be some discretionary items that I can cut out.
Oh, yeah.
So that's where the calculation that we're getting to, I approach it from the perspective of what expenses would I absolutely be required to continue paying for me to live and not screw up my credit. Those are the two most important variables, right? So that's going to be our rent and then any debt we have, so that we don't miss a debt payment and end up screwing up our credit, because that can really come back to bite you.
Yeah. But, and I'm trying to build my credit right now, right? Because I just went up 80 points almost.
Yeah.
So, paying off my, but so you said 3,000, but probably right now 2,200 is closer to the accurate number of necessary funds.
Necessary.
Maybe 2,500, exactly. We could say. Right?
Sure. Makes it a little more even.
So that, right? If we do 6 months, that's $15,000 in cash. But so in maybe cash. 12,000, because I don't need the whole 6 months or something like that in cash, right? Mm-hmm. That would be like a good goal to have.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other issue, or go ahead.
I was going to say, so the one issue that with that, right, is it feels a little lofty relative to what other goals you want to accomplish, right? Yeah.
Well, it's a goal, though, so I don't have to have it right now.
Right.
Like, I think probably I should have like 6,000 as soon as possible reserved, right? Mm-hmm. Would that make sense? Like, to have a couple months?
That's what I was going to say. Like, you don't have kids, you don't have a mortgage yet. Your output of expenses in the event of an emergency are really quite low. So the opportunity cost of trying to save $12,000 just in cash for your situation may not be the best use of all of our resources. It might be, maybe over time, we're simultaneously trying to reach 12,000 while we're also investing in our 403B.
Yeah,
and that's awesome. We're accumulating two things at the same time. But the initial cash nut, if you will, for these numbers, $6,000 would get you more than 2 months to live without needing any income. So if you think about that, that's quite a bit of time, especially for someone with your skill set that can adjust, has been used to this kind of lifestyle, has invested a lot in your own skill set. You probably have a much easier time pivoting if something were to happen with your current job or your current income sources to be able to jump onto some new ship. And so that also translates into having slightly less. So even with those factors, 12,000 would be a really nice cushion, but for your situation at the moment, until it becomes a little more complex from a cash flow perspective, like you got more things you need to pay for, it probably makes more sense for you to err on the side of maybe 2 months of expenses.
Oh, I see. So the other side of this is because I have those five streams of income, and a good chunk of that is from non-W-2, non-wages. So with my W-2, my full-time job wages, that is, taxes are being taken out of that. So another part of this is, you know, there's all these different elements that now I'm gonna have to start saving some, because my tax burden on the my tax bracket has gone way right. up, which means that although for my W-2, you know, they're taking out, normally in normal circumstances I would probably expect to get some money of that back. But because I also have a good amount of money coming from these other four streams of income, I'm going to have to probably owe more.
Right. And then you haven't paid any taxes on any of that money, whereas your paycheck has taxes withheld. So you have to, in theory, withhold your own taxes from that other money.
Yeah.
And that can factor in too, but that should be exclusive
that's
of
what I mean. Yeah,
so that we're talking about.
So when I think about like the goal and how much my income is and how much I'm spending, and then it's like, okay, so I'm trying to get to $10,000-$12,000 or maybe just $6,000-$8,000 or something like that for now to have a minimum for this stuff. But that's on top of these other savings goals, like a tax savings goal. And then if I want, you know, then of course I'm my income through the ARI, the W-2 full-time job, some of that I'm putting, or as much as possible, putting into the 403B so that I can, that's the 401k for nonprofits, so that I can get, you know, what they have and, you know, have that for retirement. And that's, you know, not going to ever touch that. So my actual revenue is going down, in terms of what can go into that, the $6,000 to $8,000 or this, that cushion.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, there's the other things of like, I want to do more traveling. And then if I think about doing, you know, so I need to have like a travel fund about how much, and traveling is getting a little bit, like even though flights are cheaper, I mean, I'm finding Airbnb and hotels are way more expensive.
Kind of
than
pricey.
They were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I do feel that too. They've kind of gone up.
Yeah. And rented cars seems to have gone up a little bit. So, you know, it's not as cheap as I was hoping. You know, which is okay. I understand. That's just the way, you know, right now, everybody, I think demand has gone up so much that maybe there's not quite as much supply to attract it. So the prices of what's there is gone up. So anyway, you know, so that's something I'm trying to consider and like weigh all of those different things.
All of those moving parts. Yeah. Right. And so that also speaks to why I feel like 6,000 is a sweeter spot for you, because it's a little more achievable in a shorter time frame.
Yeah.
And then it also allows you to work in that vacation budget into your monthly budget, because vacations are going to happen hopefully at least annually, if not maybe a couple of times a year. And so we don't want to be investing money into the stock market, for example, to be used for that goal, right? That's still going to need to be paid from our cash because it's so frequent.
Well, if I could say like just something, so I agree with what you're saying, but I, you know, I'm actually thinking about doing more frequent, smaller vacations to try that out. Like weekend trips, right? Like just leave on a Friday, come back Sunday night or something, and go catch a show in New York City or something like that. Like, especially since flights are so low. But anyway, so it's still to your point, same point, but just like there's, you know, think
it's more of a budget. It's more of a budget item rather than like a set aside investment fund for travel.
I see what you're saying.
So
I mean, there's a lot to consider with all of it. The, you know, the other thing is like getting my credit card limit up, but not letting that hurt me by going into debt too much and not taking that out. So like, I'm going to ask them if they're my credit card company, if they're interested in, you know, raising my rate, my limit or whatever. So I have a pretty low limit at the moment, especially for how much I make now. But yeah.
But then being cautious about, as you've already illustrated, one of your weak points is that having that ability, having that access can't translate into overspending, right? So, and if you think about, as we talked about, the context of how you decide on how much cash to have, any incremental debts that I accumulate result in the need for me to increase that cash position, because those are all obligations that I'm putting myself on the hook for. So that just reinforces the fact that don't increase the amount of debt you're using or carrying as a balance, because that factors into my monthly total budget. That's my absolute necessity that I have to pay, because one of those things is debt service, because it'll screw up your credit if you can't pay it. So keep that in mind too, because it all has a ripple effect, right? Yeah. So the more we can maintain our cash flow by living within our means, the less cash we have to carry in our savings account, which is sort of a drag to some extent on our accumulation of wealth, thereby freeing up more cash flow for us to invest.
Yeah. So it's a lot. And this is, you know, like another yearly expense to kind of help with all this, like, is basically a CFP and having somebody go through all this and figuring out which is, you know, cause it's just, it's so much like, how much of my time do I want to spend doing all of it and thinking about how much to invest and how much to do. And, you know, so it makes sense to hire somebody, you know, at that level to kind of help you manage all of these questions, so I could focus on the other things that I'm trying to do to build even more income down the line,
right?
Like, that's the point, I think, of getting a CFP, especially as you're growing. And we've done a show. So like, what I'm doing is we've done shows on this, and you've actually interviewed other people about, you know, having like a hobby on the side that actually makes money, which is a very nice thing to have, to like have your full-time job and, you know, to have something on the side that makes money. And that's basically what I'm doing. But I did it kind of in reverse. Like, I had all the hobbies, and I built the systems over years to do these four streams of income. And then I got hired by a company while those were already in place. Right. And there is, which was nice. So it was a kind of a nice little addition for me, which is, you know, not for everybody, but the reverse could also be true, where you have your 9-to-5 and you could spend, you know, a couple hours a week just building on the side some other business,
right?
That you love to do. Like,
it's
love
a good,
all this stuff. So,
yeah, it's a good technique. So,
you got to figure out how to manage it,
right?
Because that's the other situation, and that's why
as it gets bigger and more complex, that's what it's going to require more attention for sure. Same with your money, right?
Well, exactly. So,
absolutely. So, to the intro of the episode, the magic question and the answer I have for how much cash you should keep in your savings account, it depends.
Yeah, that's basically always the answer. It depends, yeah. So yeah, no easy answer, but I liked it. It helped, very helpful. I mean, for me, I think we have a decent answer for my goal. So I have a goal of 6 to 8,000, basically.
Yep, that's your goal.
And that's like when you talk to a CFP, you're going to have a number. So although on the show, we don't give you, the listener, a number, because it depends on who you are and what you're interested in, and your plans, your goals, your income, your investments, inheritance, you know, assets, everything, mortgage. Yep. So all those factors have to go into play. So on a show, we can't tell you what your number is. But if you know, work with a CFP, you definitely can't, you should get a number. That's the point.
Yeah,
working with the CFP.
If they can't give you a number, then there's really no point in them working with you.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, that wraps up this episode of Jake of All Trades. Be sure to check us out on social media by searching for @Jake's2Cents, and check out the blog at jakes2cents.com. Take care. We'll see you next time.
Securities and advisory services offered through Commonwealth Financial Network. Member FINRA, SIPC. A registered investment advisor. Fixed insurance products and services offered through CES Insurance Agency. Actual performance and results will vary. These interviews do not constitute a recommendation as to the suitability of any investment for any person or persons having circumstances similar to those portrayed. Consult a financial advisor regarding your specific circumstances.